All right, today is Eric Kelliner. Thanks so much for joining. Today we're talking about engineering growth and career pathing. So why don't we start with, you know, the story of your career growth?
Awesome. Well, great. Thanks, Dave. I'm excited to be here and to share this narrative with you. In terms of my career growth, I think in some ways it started in a very traditional or more common area that, you know, as a kid, I kind of knew what I wanted to do. Got exposed to a computer, and I think it was middle school. It was an Apple II, I think it was, in the back of a math class. There's this new thing I was really interested in. A year later, my dad brought home this TRS-80 for the house and played chess on it all day. And I was just enamored by it. There's this thing that you can use programming languages to automate and have it do things for you. So I was really kind of hooked early on. I knew that that's what I wanted to do. I didn't know exactly what area, but I knew what I was interested in. Got into, Logo, which I think was the hotness at that time, Basic, and really kind of just honed in on that and was very curious about technology and communication. I went to school, got traditionally trained computer science. While I was there at school, I worked part-time at a number of different companies that needed software engineers. So I got a chance to kind of put some of those skills as I was learning them to work. And I think it was my junior year, I ran into a geography professor at my university, and we were talking. In fact, I think the way that it happened was I was interviewing for a law firm that asked, hey, we need a software engineer to do these things. And when I started interviewing, they really didn't need a software engineer. They needed a data entry person. And I said, well, this is probably not a good fit. And the person I was interviewing with said, yeah, that I agree. There's actually a buddy down the hall I have. He walked me down the hall, and it was this room with a bunch of geography professors from the university. And they were solving these really interesting problems. They were all PhDs, and this was kind of a little bit of a moonlighting operation. There were three of them in a room, and they were really focused on creating models that would model consumer behavior, things that would be natural in the world. They wanted to simulate and predict. They were using gravity models, entropy models that were harnessed and put into a customer prediction system that was used for banks to help understand if one bank bought another, or they closed one branch, what would likely happen to the customers? Would they lose them? Would they go to another branch? And that would simulate and model what would happen. I thought that was fascinating. They had these great ideas, but they didn't have an engineer to help kind of bring these into any kind of an application. So long story short, I ended up working with them and part-time through school, and worked on really great complex problems with them. I also decided to go back, and this was actually as the recommendation of the owner of the company, is go back and get my master's. And as it turns out, he was an advisor for my thesis and ended up being a great mentor for me and someone I keep in touch with today. And we ended up solving really unique problems. In the company, there was so much autonomy for me, which I think framed a lot of my own experiences and belief systems on organizational autonomy and giving individuals the choice to kind of grow their own direction. This was my first kind of, I'd say, real job out of school that I got a chance to experience in kind of a, I guess what we would call it, at, you know, looking back, was a startup. We ended up growing to probably about 25 people. Didn't really have any organizational structure surrounded by it. I got a chance to write great software, meet clients, understand problems, and without any constraints and boundaries. So it was an incredible experience. The mentor that I had was incredible in framing my thoughts on like what's possible with broad levels of trust and autonomy. And I made mistakes, and which typically happens when you kind of take on those kind of autonomy cycles. But it was an incredible experience that I look back fondly, and I think has framed my philosophies on mentorship, trust, autonomy, and accountability. The company we ended up selling was there for about 7 years. We ended up selling to a private equity firm, and then I ended up going off and I wanted to get into entertainment. So I ended up joining Warner Brothers, their first digital entertainment company. And that was my first role where I was in a big company and kind of quote unquote corporate. And but it was kind of sexy because it was this small division as Warner Brothers, about 30 people. And as it turns out, one of the members of the company was a guy by the name of Jeff Weiner, who was on business development for Warner Brothers. And Jeff went on to do a lot of really great things and is the CEO of LinkedIn. So it was really kind of neat to kind of see some transitions. But going back to the early stages, I was hired on as an engineer. And I ended up getting my first opportunity within a few months to manage a group of people. And I got to say, I was horrible at it. My first chance to manage people, I saw the people I managed as kind of extensions or tentacles. I'll use kind of that analogy, rather than individuals. And I just didn't have the tools and skills at it. I look back at it and there were so many things I could have done differently, but it was a great experience nevertheless. I ended up getting a new mentor who was the head of engineering, who was incredible, incredibly supportive of my own growth. At the time, I was super aggressive in terms of growing both my breadth and depth in engineering. This was a new landscape, new types of technology, and he was fully supportive of it. In fact, as I talked to him about growing, his question for me was, do you want to take my role? Which kind of surprised me in kind of my views and my thoughts on corporate entertainment is very kind of cutthroat and, you know, everybody's protected. And here was this very altruistic perspective of like, hey, you look like you could really do this. How about you take on my role? And first thing I'm thinking is like, well, wait, where's the catch, or what does he want to do? Is he leaving? He says, no, I think you would be a really good, I'll move on to do other things at the company, but you'd be a good at this role. And that kind of blew me away to the point where I put together a pitch and a proposal of reorganization of an organization that I didn't even lead. And he was fully supportive of this trend. And I look back at that as one of the skills and one of the things that framed me was this concept of selflessness, of kind of putting that need above your own desire. And again, reinforcing the importance of mentoring and supporting someone in their career growth was huge. And at the same time, I also recognized that I want to be a better leader. So I ended up doing that. And then a number of different companies, I took on a CTO role for my first time, where I was an executive with a seat at the table, worked with some high scale platforms like Ticketmaster, ran an engineering team there, and where I hired a number of individual contributors, but also grew my first manager. And that was for me, that was an exciting but also painful experience. When you are growing someone who's going from an individual contributor to a manager, there's a big leap. And if they're not ready for it, and you as the manager are not ready to put in the time and effort, it's going to be painful. And I think that was a huge learning for me, that not everybody is ready or even interested in moving from an individual contributor to a manager role. They can still be leaders at a company, but it really kind of takes a desire to work with people. And that was a huge learning for me when I ended up working with this individual as they converted to become a manager at the organization.
Yeah, you know what? And this has been a common theme throughout all of these discussions we've had in this series about how folks have approached that and so forth. And, you know, there's many different examples that people have shared in that regard. But in general, it's making it a safe zone or something like a rollbackable transaction where if it doesn't work out, they can return to an IC and engineering path and so forth without the shame and so forth. So that's really great to hear. And it sounds like, you know, earlier on you were saying you were afforded that too. So that's great. So, I mean, talk more about that. You're talking about the IC to manager shift, right? Mm-hmm. So let's talk more about that challenge when you were growing that your first time.
Yeah. So I have a word or phrase I use that I have kind of a half written article that talks about this, but I call it letting go of the keyboard. It's a challenge and something that I went through myself because I questioned my, you know, I've been trained in this craft of software engineering nearly my whole life. And now I realize that, wait, if I want to be a manager, I may not be able to spend as much time in front of the keyboard writing code. Doesn't mean you have to drop entirely, but even the thought of kind of removing that, pulling that organ out of you or giving it and filling it up with something else was terrifying. And something that I struggled with for months, not really knowing, do I want to do this? Can I return back? And if I do return back, my fear was, would I have atrophied with technologies moving so fast? Could I have done that? So I struggled with a lot of fears with it, and ultimately decided that I could return back, that, you know, I kind of had one foot in where I was just dabbling a little bit. So then I had one foot in on one side, and then I kind of reached a point where I realized that's okay if I atrophy a little bit. And it's okay to be scared and have that fear. And I ended up ultimately where I am now in my life. I only have maybe one finger on the keyboard, if that. And it was a tough struggle. So I understood that struggle moving from an IC to a manager myself. And I think it helped me empathize with individuals that go through that same area. One of the other struggles, I think, is at the time, the concept of growth and career pathing for people in technology was usually a single lane or a single track. So If you want to grow, you got to be a manager. And if you want to grow a manager, you have to be a director. And those are all titles, less about roles. But those became always kind of question marks for me. That when I thought about career growth and career pathing, either for myself or my team, I always thought about it, and I didn't have the language or the terminology, but I always thought about, well, wait, there should be multiple tracks for this. Why isn't there? There's also what I think about in terms of career growth is I think about both depth and breadth of growth, which I later kind of landed on concepts of scope and impact. And that's the way I think about in a kind of two-dimensional space. I think about individuals their career pathing and their different roles that they take on is looking at it both as what is the scope of their role and then ultimately what their impact is. And you, that allows you to create kind of parity from a kind of career growth standpoint between the individuals who are amazing individual contributors who have huge impact. They may not have a large scope, but they have huge impact. And then looking at perhaps another individual that has a wide scope of responsibility, but their impact may not be as large. So those things can be equivalent. And so this concept of creating multiple branches of career tracking is something that I had kind of thought about and refined over the years after talking with others who struggled and thought of the same concepts. So then I went on to a digital agency as their CTO, where I had to support both managers and individual contributors. It was a fairly flat hierarchy in terms of looking at career pathing. It was honestly, it was a bit of a struggle in a digital agency as a service organization. They really aren't designed to really think about career pathing. Mostly because turnover so high and, bench time and billable hours, low margins, those things all created a sense of resistance. But at the same time, it helped create an incentive for me to start a new adventure, which I did about 6 or 7 years ago. And I decided after the digital agency, I really love the idea of servicing other groups and companies. And I wanted to figure out how can I do it on my own. I didn't necessarily have a great product startup idea when I came out on my own, but I spent about 3 months interviewing people who knew me and also interviewing others who have kind of started their own consultancy. Some of who are members of the LACTO forum that I interviewed. And what I landed on doing is I wanted to start my own practice being specifically around leadership development. So I ended up building a practice around being a consulting CTO, but also focused on leadership development, which ultimately became executive coaching for me. And I started out working with a lot of great companies in a coaching role, working with growing leaders, ones that were perhaps stretched in uncomfortable ways as they made their transition to perhaps a manager of managers or divisional head, that all of a sudden they have an organization of 50 people, ones that are taking responsibility for areas where, again, they are stretched in super uncomfortable ways. And that was the thing I was drawn to, is to kind of help them go through this process through through coaching. And that kind of brings me in where I am today. And so I work with CEOs, I work with CTOs, I work with technology, or any kind of leader that is interested in growing and helping them to pay as an executive to become the leader that people want to follow. And that's where I focus my time on today.
That's great. I bet you get to see a lot of different case scenarios and have a lot of good successes and case studies, I should say.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely a pretty diverse area, and I get to see different scenarios underway. There were companies that I helped develop career models with, or recruiting strategies, bringing some of my own experiences, some of the piles of poop that I've stepped in and how to avoid them, but also some of the areas on changing or influence the mindset. Like one of the areas that I have a strong opinion on is in terms of both recruiting and career pathing, is this concept of moving away from titles in an organization and focusing more on roles, where individuals can participate. You know, just about every, even if you're just an individual contributor on a team, you may have multiple roles, and then you have levels of expertise within that role. And so I usually, where companies sometimes get caught up, and I help them to kind of rethink it, is to look at breakdown. And first step is develop a sense of role clarity. And I think that helps both the engineers, or really anyone on their team, understand what are the roles that they're performing, what are the roles that the organization needs, and how well are they performing in each of those roles. An example of that may be, you could have someone who's a performing an engineer on a team that is perhaps performing a tech lead role, someone who is perhaps responsible for the technical vision or the technical quality of the products or services created with that team. That is a role. How well are they doing that? And what's expected of somebody in that role is perhaps is technical mentoring an important part of that role? Those are the types of things that I think about and that I see, and I am able to kind of engage on developing these things in partnership with organizations.
Yeah, absolutely. You hit on a good point there, because like with the mentoring especially, you have the multiplier effect, and these things, you know, as part of your growth, you may want to teach a class about React, or you may want to attend the lunch and learn about it or whatever. And anywhere you can find and align growth with the company and multiplier effects, it makes a big difference for the org, you know, many different
definitely
ways.
I think I completely aligned with that. And that's where kind of going back to this concept of scope and impact, you could have somebody who maybe their scope is not large, but they are a strong mentoring, so that multiplier effect has huge impact across the organization. And that should be valued by the organization, because there are so many well-written studies that talk about the value of mentorship and how that helps not only the individual, but it helps the individual who's mentoring. So it's a kind of, it's a benefit in both directions.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a cool quote from the series was Laura Thompson, who's over at Mozilla, said that the best product from senior engineers are more senior engineers, right?
So yeah.
In fact, in order in their org to get higher up, you had to like basically mentor a lot and a lot and a lot to be regarded as a higher, you know, higher level on the engineering excellence track, you know?
Yes, yes. And there's, you know, in terms of the different archetypes, I'd say, of engineering leaders, there was a guy that I worked with that he had no interest in being, he was highly introverted. He didn't really like to get up and present and build vision, but he loved working with junior engineers and interns. Like that was, you saw him light up, because he saw that that was his value. And that was where his superpower was, that he was able to bring to the organization. And that that is such a great thing when you see that. They, you know, obviously he was really well skilled at what he did in his own craft. And he didn't necessarily want to lead an organization or a team or become a broad strategic architect. He really wanted to deliver great value by growing, bringing in young blood, growing them to be the next generation of leaders, which is awesome.
Yeah, you know, and I've seen this as a good icebreaker when you're doing first contact or you're meeting new folks who, you know, probability is they are introverted. A lot of engineers are, but a good way to get them talking is about, like, what's the coolest thing you've built in the last year or ever, mm-hmm. you know, et cetera. Or what kind of YouTube videos are you watching right now at lunch? Or, you know, there's all kinds of, you know, people can, it doesn't matter if they're introverted, if they're into the subject matter, you can't get them to stop talking about it. And that's how you get someone going in my opinion, in a good interview, because you know, there's a fight or flight response going on with people, and you get them on comfortable terms on their turf, you know. And that's great. That's what you're talking about with this individual. It's like, and actually I've seen people do the same thing, and then they realized they had it, and then they were able to go to another level of public communications because their feeder league was like with their own peers and so forth. So that's a great story that mixes in really well.
Yeah. The, one kind of quick example that I you know, it's such a great example of like getting people to share what they're passionate about. One of the companies that I've consulted with is Riot Games, and their engineering interview loops were part of the component that you would interview with. Is it was called Teach Us Something. And the candidates who were interviewing would bring in a topic that they are super passionate about. It could be anything from, I think the most interesting one that I sat in was brewing the perfect cup of coffee. There was someone who was an engineer who was phenomenally deep into understanding how to make great coffee. So it didn't, some did it, like you said, React, or they were looking at Scala they were excited about, or Kafka, you know, whatever it happened to be. It could be a technical subject, but it didn't have to be. And so as they go through their interview loop, they, after lunch, they spend 15 or 20 minutes and they sit in a room with probably anywhere from 5 to 10 people. And they really just talk about what they're passionate about. And that's one of the things that Riot looked for in terms of hiring individuals. It's like, what are they super passionate about? And are they curious? Are they deeply engaged in a subject topic? So it's a kind of reaffirmation of what you were saying.
Excellent. So if we could go back to some of the organizational aspects of people growing and, you know, career path and so forth, maybe we could talk about that jump from when you might have had a small team to a whole organization. So what are some of the other tactics you can kind of use to get it out in the open and show it's part of your ethos? We've already talked about a few, but what other examples do you have of like in an engineering first culture? You mentioned earlier, by the way, you worked at an agency. That's not engineering first. I'm talking about like engineering first companies where people can spend all day at lunch geeking out on things, et cetera. You know, so let's talk about more examples in that vein.
Sure. So, and I think specifically to talk about the areas around transitioning from a manager of a team to a leader of an organization, like what was that like? So I think for me, it was certainly a work in progress or iterable process for me. And it challenged me in a couple of ways, because one of the things that I recognized as the scope of the teams that I support grew, so did the impact of my communication and the words I chose. So words are important, and sometimes they could be misconstrued. And the larger the organization you have, the more opportunity there is for things to be mistaken or misinterpreted. When you have a small team, you have that kind of one layer of communication. But as you start to get two or three levels up or beyond, there's an opportunity for miscommunication on what you want to do, what you mean by your words. And so choosing them carefully, I think, was one of the biggest learnings I had in terms of my own scaling. The other challenge I had was around helping to influence how delegation happens in an organization and how to get good at it. There's actually an article that been published at the end of the year that is specifically focused on the area of delegation, thinking about why many, even executives these days, feel that they struggle with delegation. And that's something that I had to confront early on as I moved from a manager of an individual team, where there may not be as complex delegations, but when you move to a manager of managers, the delegation aspect becomes really, really important, because you have an opportunity to influence someone who then is going to influence someone in their team, or someone, you know, and recurse that a number of times over. So it became really important to ensure that the right strategies for team delegation or whatever you're working on and passing it off, and not not kind of being complacent with, you know, a satisfactory delegation or handoff of the system, but rather something that you want to encourage the highest bar and the highest level of quality of delegation that you can do. And so those are two things that kind of come to mind that I focused on and that I was challenged with, is both the kind of communication, but also delegation. Those were challenging when I moved from a manager of a team to manager of managers. That became, those are the two areas that kind of came up for me.
Okay, excellent. And so when we talk about growth and career pathing, et cetera, they can be intertwined quite a bit. Like, for example, the growth that you do in the short run compounds itself and gets you inevitably down the ladder, not inevitably, but ideally down the ladder, right? And it could be on a dual track. You could be jumping across over to the management side or whatever. But so these small steps with growth lead to an overall direction, right? And that direction can change and so forth. So, you know, within your orgs, how are you managing the expectations, or how are you managing the aspirations as well, as from when they come in to say when they leave the company? Like, how do you help them along that arc?
Hmm. Okay, great question. So I think the way I think about career pathing is it has kind of the two elements to it. It has what interests the individuals, what are they passionate about, what is it that they want to take on, do they want to challenge themselves with a wider scope, or do they want to focus on a broader or deeper impact, do they want to go deep into areas of technologies or systems, do they want to focus more on strategy than tactics? Are they, as you pointed out, are they interested in people in terms of supporting a team? They also, the other side of that obviously is what the business needs. And really, how does the business, what do they currently have? And where do they need to, are they going to need in the future? And it's really kind of marrying those two is what the core proposition is. There's a lot of different ways that I've kind of thought about it, but they do center around first establishing the common language between looking at what an individual is interested in doing and what the business needs, is centering around this concept of role clarity, because I think that helps build a common language of the different types of roles in the organization. What is it that can appeal to the individual who's interested in growing their career? Yeah. It may not exist, but looking at those individual roles, they may be able to combine something and create their own proposition that they want to grow their career on.
Yeah, definitely. I totally agree with all of that you just said there. So what about like rituals, and what's the cadence of how you check in on all of this? How do you deal with that?
Okay, got it. So rituals and perhaps artifacts is one of the things I subscribe to is you can call it different things, PDPs, personal development plans. Something that talks a little bit about what they want to do. And it also serves as an area for them to kind of keep current. They look at like, what are the goals I want to accomplish over the next 3 months, 6 months, and 12 months? What's my next role or next step for me as an individual? So I encourage all team members, and I use my own as an example, is to develop their personal development plan. And that's something that would be developed and revisited. It isn't necessarily a static document. In fact, encouraging at least every year do a refresh, sometimes every 3 to 6 months, depending if something changes in their role. And it also gives them the ability to create short-term goals for them on their way to map what their broader term goal is. So it creates this shared understanding so that I'm aware of what they want to do. And I'm also, as perhaps the leader of the organization, I have broader insight into where opportunities exist. And so it gives, by having them put this together, and it's less about the document and more about the discussion that happens, but it's a starting point, is where we kind of map out what are their weaknesses, what are the areas they want to improve upon, what are their strengths, and what's kind of in the road ahead for them. And it's something that we revisit on a quarterly basis they review it with their manager. And it really serves as a good guiding mechanism to support their own career growth. And they could look back at it 6 months as like, hey, did I accomplish these goals? These are my own personal development goals. And it helps the leadership organization understand how can they ultimately help this person along their career trajectory. So that would be really one of the starting points, is using this common artifact as a discussion point,
yeah,
of looking to support their career growth.
Yep, great. So let's talk about individuals that you've worked with in your time that had sort of outsized growth. And what I mean by that is, you know, a lot of the people I've talked to in this series, a lot of orgs are using merit over everything else. So it's not just the number of years on the job, right? It's mm-hmm. what you can do and your level of autonomy, or maybe if you're a manager, it's your level of external effect or influence, et cetera. But what I'm talking about is, you know, let's talk about individuals who went through their arc faster than the norm. What does the archetype of that look like in your experience?
Kind of those, just to make sure I understand, like a 10Xer? Whatever,
sure, you could probably call it that.
Bit.
Yeah.
If it's someone who's kind
11X or whatever, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's a really good point. So I think about there's also one thing I'll talk about, another tool that I use, which helps kind of highlight some of these individuals. There's a tool that has gotten, I think, a bad rap for the way it's used, but there's a tool called succession planning. It's called Ninebox or succession planning. And it's a great tool to look at your organization or look at your team relative to each other on the team, where you map out two different axes, the performance and potential vectors. And I think it's a super powerful tool for any manager of a team to kind of look at their organization. And the ones that are in the top right are ones that are both high potential, meaning they've exhibited some demonstrable level of expertise beyond what their current role is, as well as they're performing beyond what their current expectations of their performance. So when I think about individuals that need to be fed, when and this kind of goes into also as a leader, where do you spend your time supporting individuals that maybe are not performing in the norm and that need to kind of go up to the median? And then you have individuals that you need to feed. So philosophies or strategies around it, but I look at spending a lot of time with the individuals who need to be fed to grow. And there was a guy that was constantly quarter over quarter, because I would review this 9-box tool on a quarterly basis, quarter over quarter was just constantly in that upper right corner, and ultimately once somebody ends up there, it means you're not challenging them enough. So that's a reflection on the manager, is that if you don't keep this person fed and challenged, they're going to get bored, especially in this, if you call them 10xers, 11xers, or high potential. There's a kind of a unique dynamic about those individuals, that they are just hungry and you have to feed them. And so promotion is one way to do it, but there's other intrinsic ways that you can motivate them, that giving them the scope, giving them the areas that they're most passionate about, challenging them in areas that maybe they didn't think they could do. That's the goal of a leader in terms of supporting a career growth. You want to challenge them potentially in uncomfortable ways. Otherwise, they're going to get bored. And so I've kind of followed that strategy or that philosophy around challenging the individual in keeping this, what we now call that kind of growth mindset, willing to try different things out, willing to fail, try different things out, succeed, and push them until they're not just succeeding at every possible thing. They do have a little bit of failure, which makes you as a manager recognize, okay, so I'm challenging them in a good way. If they're just knocking everything out that you do quarter over quarter and there's nothing you can do, then maybe you're not challenging them enough. The other thing that I think about in terms of supporting those high growth individuals or high performing individuals is I think about not only their scope and impact, but I also think about motivators. I am a huge fan of looking at intrinsic motivators. And I think there's nothing wrong with extrinsic motivators, but I think the specifically for technical talent that I found, and that's the area that I do know and spent my whole career with, is that the things that motivate them are, there's a lot of opportunity for intrinsic motivation, whether that is exploring new platforms, new structures, new systems, the running a community of practice, taking on different types of responsibilities, I've found is a great extrinsic motivator. Giving someone a chance to just kind of take a break from the week to week grind and kind of do like a sabbatical of sorts to spend time in research on an area that they're passionate about. Those are great motivators, because chances are these individuals are well compensated. So it's not about money, but it's about how are they learning? How are they being challenged? How are they able to kind of pursue their passions? And I think those are ways that I look at addressing those high performance individuals. The one thing I'll also say about that is there's a, I think there's a, there is a, an edge to the supporting these individuals. And I believe there is some kind of a DNA marker with these super high octane individuals. And they kind of lack the natural governor that most people do, so that, which means they are more susceptible to burnout. And that's something that is really important to kind of keep mindful of as you're challenging them. I think they have higher RPMs than others, but being mindful of potential burnout is really, really important.
Yeah, they burn out though. They don't rust out, right?
Yes. It's a great way of saying it. Yes. I don't know if we can go back to it, but when you were asking the question about changes of shifts when I started managing managers, one of the areas that I learned a lot about is less about creating a kind of healthy team culture. When you move from manager to managers, you're less about creating a team culture, a healthy team culture, and it's more about creating the environment where a healthy team culture can emerge.
100%.
And I think there's a difference between that, where you're focused more on creating the landscaping and letting the growth happen organically, creating guidelines and creating rails around it, but also putting the right types of soil in place for, and I'm kind of going on this organic growth analogy, but you're creating that soil and creating the landscaping, but ultimately the seeds have to grow themselves. And that's where you step back a little bit and let a manager that you trust kind of build the team the way that they think is going to work the best, because they're going to have the best proximity. I just wanted to add that other piece to
it. Yeah, sort of like the topiary artist, you know?
yeah, exactly. Yeah, good analogy.
All right. So, you know, during this time frame when you had been growing orgs, you know, did you find any successes with promoting managers from within, or did you typically hire them from outside?
Great question. So, I would always try to bias, towards promoting internally if the individual was passionate about it. And I was willing to put in the time and effort. If I was not willing to, and I had to be honest with myself, is if an individual who wanted to be a manager was interested in it, but I just didn't have the capacity to do it, I might shy away from that, or I wasn't able to get them the capacity support they needed. I think there are some good reasons why you sometimes want to bring somebody in from the outside. I want to name those because it's really important, is sometimes you just need to have a fresh perspective in an organization. I think it's less about what I found. It's less about experience and skill in that area, because those things can come over time. But sometimes you need, if you know, you don't want a group of who all have grown up with the same philosophy and been taught the same strategy, because they may not be adding to the pot to grow the organization into a kind of more diverse, valuable, critical thinking model. So you want to look at alternative ways to do it. So I do support the idea of bringing somebody from the outside if that's what the organization needs. Or alternatively, if you don't have the capacity or you don't have individuals who are interested in it, There have been times, and I myself have both grown individuals who maybe I kind of convinced myself into thinking that they could do the job if I squinted really tight and whatnot, or I convinced myself that they were really dedicated to it. But I've also, at times, I've hired managers into organizations where I fooled myself into lowering the bar.
Right.
Time and time again, I've never seen it succeed for me.
Yeah.
And so I learned that after a number of stumbles if someone's not ready for it and they don't want it, and you got to have those eyes wide open. Don't do it. And same thing goes for, no matter how much your pain is in terms of hiring, pulling in somebody who you have to lower the bar for, because it will come back to bite you every time.
Yeah, definitely. That what you said there too resonates with me. In my last company at VideoAmp, we were growing rapidly, but we needed to promote lots of managers. We had to actually hire from outside because we couldn't necessarily bring up an IC or an engineer and didn't have the resources to train them. But once we had hired enough like EMs and eventually even directors of engineering, there was a guild at that level. And there was a whole support group there. And it was much easier for the rest of our folks to grow when we hired a lot better players at every level in the org. And so that was a concern for us. And at the same time, like you just said, we needed the efficiencies and the outside perspectives and actually advocates for things we already advocated for, like CI/CD and coverage and testing. And it's like, we just brought in folks who thought that way. And then it was an imperative throughout the org, and it made all the difference for us, you know?
Yeah, I think I completely agree that it's huge. And I think it's, I'm kind of talking about it from a negative standpoint of, just based on the mistakes I've made in the past in terms of either field promoting the wrong person or bringing somebody in who I just felt the need for. And those tensions in the organization when you need to scale are real and they're painful. But when you don't do that, and as you kind of pointed out, like the value is so much clearer and so much more powerful when you do bring the right people in and you do have the right support structure, because you didn't lower your bar, or you didn't convince yourself that somebody else was ready when they weren't.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of imperatives, I always like to talk about imperatives when I get to know folks, and whether it's sitting there at the bar with having a beer after LACTO form or something, or just meeting people randomly, or interviewing people like we're doing now, or interviewing people for a job. It's always interesting to find out what are your top imperatives and what do you look for in building your org? What do you look for in people, process, whatever it is? What are some of your top ones?
That's a good question. I would say for me, when I'm looking to interview or hire someone, I look for curiosity. I look for questions that they're going to ask and make me think about things differently. I always look for the level of, if they don't understand something, are they willing to, in an interview, say like, hold on, what was that acronym? Or, hey, so why do you guys go about doing this? Curiosity, I think, is huge for me. I have some go-to interview questions that regardless of the role, that I encourage and do myself to ask. There's kind of reflective questions around self-awareness, which I believe, and I probably have some biases that I've developed over the time, but I believe self-awareness is kind of a touchstone to growth. I believe that resilience, sometimes I ask one of my favorite interview questions is, asking about, tell me about a time when you had to push a boulder. What was this big boulder that you had to push up the hill? And why was it big? Did you struggle with it? Why did you struggle with it? And ultimately, were you able to push the boulder up the hill? So looking at like, what are the struggles they faced against? Because look, you're going to face challenges and roadblocks in just about any position, certainly in technology, but you know, you can apply those areas. So I look for kind of resilience as well. Those are the areas. I'm not one of those who is hung up on a specific area of expertise and a specific number of years in an area, because I believe that, you know, if there's some analogy or just showing diversity of experience and ability to learn, then that's fine. Unless it's something so unique, in which case, if nobody in the organization has it, maybe you get a consultant and the expertise and everybody else follows through and gets up to speed with it. But those are kind of the core areas that I would be looking at.
Excellent. Well, speaking of interviews, that ties right into the home stretch of this conversation, which is, you know, awkward interview experiences, whether you've given them or taken them, you know, like basically let's talk about that. Not necessarily to laugh, but to also learn from it too.
All right. I have one that I think is kind of funny. I'm trying to think about the learning of it, but it's still kind of there is a learning of it that I think is in there. So let me go through it. So I remember I was interviewing for a head of technology for a digital entertainment company. And I was interviewing with the COO. Just before we got started, someone came into the room and I started having a conversation. He was polite, says, "Hey, are you okay if you just hold on here for a sec?" And so I was witnessing this conversation. And this guy came in and he had a VHS tape. And this was just give you a time frame. This was in the early 2000s. So the internet was live. Digital media was live. Commerce, you know, we're kind of in that time frame where everything was exploding. He said, "Hey, so what should I do about the tape I'm going to send to Jeff?" And I knew from just the interview, Jeff was the CEO. So the guy that I was interviewing, and by the way, Jeff wasn't his real name, but Jeff was actually looking to acquire a company. And the next day he was going to go meet with the company. So he wanted to learn a little bit about them. So the guy who brought in the videotape was basically browsing a website and recording it onto a VHS tape. So he's clicking through a website, recording it onto a VHS tape. And he says, "I'm going to courier this over to Jeff." And so after I left, the COO kind of realized like, oh shit. And he was just totally, he goes, "Look, you know, Jeff's really not that much into the internet." So he recorded the entire web session onto videotape. And so he just watches it on his videotape. And for me, it was like, wow. It was kind of a learning moment, recognizing someone who had a huge, long background in building multi-billion dollar companies in entertainment doesn't understand or isn't interested enough to spend time on the internet. Needless to say, that company's not around anymore. I didn't end up going to work for them, but it was an eye-opening experience that I've had huge assumptions on, like, oh, okay, this is a digital entertainment company. Of course they know about the internet stuff, but the chief exec didn't. And that probably spoke a lot to maybe the way they saw the opportunities. And so listening and seeing and being curious about companies and how the executives view the product or the landscape or the market is super important. So that was my story.
Yeah, interesting. Actually, before you do your next one, I'll provide a small anecdote as a tie-in to that, because I was actually jaw-dropped there when you were saying that. But I'm like, yeah, okay, I've seen this too. The whole point of my last company, VideoAmp, was dealing with convergence for digital and linear television, right? And so for 5 years, 6 years now that they're at it, they've been working with big ad agencies and the like. And, you know, there's actually always been two divisions in these agencies. One is the digital side, one is the old school TV side. And over the last 5 years or so, they've been duking it out and battling it out within the major holding companies who gets to deal with just video advertising in general. They're standardizing on not TV or not digital, just video, right? And the point is that most of all, the TV people died out. They died on the vine. They too kept their heads in the sand because they were sort of mad at the internet or whatever about the streaming and all the other things that those digital newfangled people are doing. Mm-hmm. And so just sitting on the sidelines of it, or, you know, going to meetings over the years with these companies and watching them consolidate, they've actually consolidated those same kinds of dinosaur people out. And now they're coming up under new leadership, and people who now have led digital are going back and relearning that silly television piece. Yeah. So it's kind of an evolutionary tale somewhere in there, you know?
Absolutely. No, that's a great story that really kind of aligns and speaks to the two tales and what convergence means, and, you know, accepting kind of the direction of evolution and kind of getting on the board with it one way or another. There's also kind of, I guess, a challenge to discern whether it's a fad or is it an evolutionary shift. But I think, you know, at the time, looking at, hey, there's this online thing, it's going to be a fad, it's going to roll out. I don't think, I was probably inside drinking the Kool-Aid, but I failed to recognize there were a lot of people who really saw it as a fad, something that was going to be short-lived and not turn into the world we live in.
Yeah, definitely. Got any other good interview stories, good, bad, or ugly?
So I have a story about a guy that I was interviewing. He was supposed to come on site. The only day he was able to come and interview for, I was out on vacation. And I was going to be that manager's direct report. I felt terrible, but I wasn't willing to change my family vacation. So I had made a deal with him that, look, and I found a colleague of mine who was kind of the buddy for the day, as he kind of interviewed around to different groups and would be their sponsor. And what I did was I came back on a Friday from vacation, and on a Saturday I flew out and I wanted to take him out for lunch. So I flew up to Seattle for him, and we had lunch, and I kind of pitched him. I wanted to know how he was feeling. And I came all the way out. He's like, hey, I want to join the company. I just don't know if this was the right role for me. And so, like, my heart kind of dropped when he said that. And so I said, but you did say you want to join the company. And he says, yeah, I really like the company. I just don't think this is the right role for me. So we talked about a lot of things, and I said, look, I really want you at this company. I think we'll be able to figure something out. And I didn't know what that was, but I kind of made it up. And he felt good the following, when I, on the plane back, I talked to a couple of peers who I knew were looking for someone. And they ended up, I ended up calling them back and say, look, I understand it if this isn't the right role for you. I have a colleague who's a peer of mine who's great, and I think this is based on what you described. This is what you want. And it was a win. He ended up joining, and it was kind of turning lemons into lemonade, I guess, would probably be the exciting part of it. I didn't get the hire, but I got the person to come to the company, which was, for me, maybe kind of dovetails to what we talked about earlier, is that first experience of altruism, of kind of doing something for the company above what your own needs were. And I really could have used him, but And I think he might still be at the company. So
cool.
That was kind of a win story.
Yeah, definitely. And that's a rare turn at the end there, as far as how the conversation can usually go.
Yeah. So one story is I was being recruited for a startup in the early days of this startup. And I was being recruited by a retained search firm, Korn Ferry. And I went on site and interviewed them. Or they interviewed me. We spent some time together. I went through a number of different rounds. And they said to me, Eric, we really want you at this company, but you don't have enough gray hair. And they were using it metaphorically, obviously. We wanted someone with deeper levels of experience. Are you willing to join as the second in command? And I thought that was the first time that I had been interviewed and where they wanted to hire me, but it was for a different role. And so it was, you know, the ego side of me was like, hell no, I want to be the CTO. But I really enjoyed the company. I liked the people. I liked the culture. I got a chance to spend some time with the CTO that they were recruiting. So both of us were applying for the same role. But at the end of the day, I thought that, yeah, this person does have more gray hair than me, and I could learn a lot from them. So I kind of put my ego at the door and really had a great, great run with the company. The part of the recruiting was that the recruiter recognized that and was they were originally saying, well, Eric doesn't have enough experience. And they said, okay, that's fine. But do you like Eric? And they said, yeah, like we should. So the recruiter was a big part of saying, well, why don't you just hire him as your second in command? And they had, it didn't really occur to them. So the recruiter sold that.
That's savvy of them.
Really smart. And I don't know what the compensation, what that was, but I think what they were really looking for is like, look, you say these great things about this person. They're just not ready. And I think that's a great story of talent acquisition, where when it goes well and they're really looking at solving the bigger problem, then it becomes less about like, look, this person's not right. I'd rather have this person, but I really like them. So I think it's a good tale in that story.
Yeah, definitely. Well, all right, Eric, thank you so much for joining today. This has been a great conversation, a lot of really good overlaps and a lot of places where I wanted to jump in, but just let you go because it was such a good conversation. So thanks for coming on and talking about it today.
Yeah, thank you, Dave. This was a great opportunity. I'm grateful to be part of this, and I look forward to hearing what the other interviews have to say. So thank you.